attention to the next slide, please. Some additional details about how the energy market helps. The amount of wind generation that would be necessary to achieve a 20% renewable portfolio standard is on the order of 5,700 megawatts of generation. For perspective, that's more than the output of the Xcel plants at Prairie Island 1 and 2, Sherco 1, 2, and 3, the King plant, and Minnesota Power's Boswell plant. So there'll be times when all of that wind is on all at the same time. We have to be able to accommodate those kinds of shifts. So that's why that larger marketplace is an important attribute in terms of being able to balance all that wind. It's also important to talk about, from a cautionary note, some of the things that were not studied in the wind integration study. So to slide six, there was not an actual transmission design made as part of that study. There were facilities that were put in the model in order to make it run, but they were hypothetical facilities. There's no commitment at this time by any utility to actually construct all the facilities that will be required. We also must integrate a transmission system with other uses. Another use that might be important, for example, there may be increased hydro generation development in Manitoba. That increased development there will have an effect on what the transmission system in Minnesota should be sized as. Wind in Iowa can also have an effect on the transmission system in Minnesota, as a couple of examples. The other thing that wasn't studied is the effect of a possible national resource portfolio standard. There are conversations at the federal level of a similar kind of 10 or 20% renewable portfolio standard. The distribution of good wind resources across the nation are heavily skewed towards our part of the world. So from Minnesota and west is where the preponderance of high-quality insights are. If there's a 20% renewable portfolio standard for the nation, we'll also have to affect moving that energy much further east. If I could direct your attention then to slide 7. One of the things we worry about as we design transmission systems is the cost effects of schedule. You probably had others here show up and talk about how those two things are related. The cost of going too quickly in terms of competition for the raw material, competition for labor, those sorts of things. We need to step into that in an orderly fashion. A program schedule that, for example, gives time for labor to hire linemen and the 4 years required of an apprenticeship to train those linemen before we have a qualified lineman are things that we need to be mindful of as we set a schedule as we try to achieve these sorts of high amounts of infrastructure. Failure to have the distribution of wind geographically dispersed also will increase the complexity with which we have to deal, because the tighter compacted the wind machines are, the more variability there is. The further apart they are, the more diverse the wind patterns are, and then as a result, the easier it is to integrate the variability in with the market. We also hope that we can be mindful of what's going on in the neighboring states so that we can coordinate all of the transmission infrastructure construction, because transmission corridor is a precious commodity. You can't make a 120-foot tall tower look good in anybody's backyard. And so we want to minimize the effect of transmission corridor to the best we can. So aggregating all of those uses so we do it once right is an important element that we're trying to facilitate. So with that in mind, the final slide that I'll talk from before I'll take questions is, I'd urge you to choose a wind energy target for Minnesota, and let's use a standard that is as soon as practical, not as soon as possible. As soon as possible tends to get you fixed price contracts that perhaps have more margin in them than they need to have. We think it's important to sequence that transmission and generation over time. And we think it's appropriate to use the existing kinds of regulatory infrastructure that's already here in Minnesota to adjust those targets and schedules as new facts present themselves as we proceed with complying with any sort of renewable portfolio standard. With that, I'd be delighted to take the committee's questions to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. I have a couple of questions to begin with. Could you describe for the committee the basis and extent of any authority that you have to deal with these questions?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Midwest ISO, as I said, is a creature of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as part of that, we are obligated to administrate a FERC open access transmission tariff. That transmission tariff is essentially the rules that everyone has to play by. It was a result of market power abuses in the early 90s that caused the FERC to open that transmission system up to all comers, whether they be small generators or big generators or utilities. So what we're obligated to do is administrate that tariff in as fair fashion as we can, and to the degree we fail to do that, it's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that steps in and provides the ultimate regulatory oversight.
And, Mr. Mueller, as far as the actual construction of transmission,
The Midwest ISO does no physical construction of transmission. The members of the Midwest ISO have a good faith obligation to attempt to construct transmission that we formally adopt as part of a regional plan. But it's between those utilities and their regulators to decide whether or not that transmission is in fact constructed.
Thank you. As regards a standard, I got a little bit confused. I thought you were saying that if the whole region adopts some kind of a renewable energy standard, that would be problematic and needs to be taken into consideration. But at the same time, you pointed out later correctly, I believe, that when generation in Minnesota were more geographically diverse, that it would help to stabilize the system. Wouldn't that be true generally?
Yes, sir, that is true generally. The point I clumsily was trying to make is that the amount of wind that is constructed changes rather dramatically if it's just a Minnesota standard or if the standard is for the entire central part of the U.S., for example. For the entire Midwest ISO footprint to accommodate a 10% renewable portfolio standard, get the consonants in the right order there, that requires about 20,000 megawatts of installed capacity of wind. If instead it's just for Minnesota, it's about 6,000 megawatts of installed capacity. So should we arrive at a 20,000 megawatt capacity number, the size of the infrastructure is rather different in terms of physically being able to deliver that energy to market. And we just want to be careful that we don't build a 345 kV line for 5,000 megawatts of wind and then come back and need to build a 765 kilovolt line because the real number was 20,000. That was the only point I was attempting to make there, sir.
Thank you. let me interrupt for a moment. Members, we do have a quorum, so we'll officially call the meeting to order. And we do have minutes from the last meeting to approve. Representative Gardner, would you care to move the minutes from January 24th?
Certainly, I move approval of the minutes.
Representative Gardner moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Sorry, Mr. Mueller. We have questions from other members. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mueller, on your slide about distribute the generation geographically, I'm assuming you're aware of the CapEx 2020 transmission studies that have been done geographically in regions around the state as they relate to the seabed statute that's in Minnesota law?
Yes, sir.
And that, wondering if you could comment on the amount or type of transmission in the 115 kV or under that might be available to geographically distribute what would potentially be a Minnesota-only standard without the need for construction of large overhead 345 kV lines.
Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. It's my understanding that the CapEx studies indicated some collection points that they use to model the higher voltage system, and that it is their intent to do additional studies on the lower voltage system to try, sir, to answer your question directly. But for perspective, in the Buffalo Ridge area, that transmission system was originally designed to accommodate between 40 and 50 megawatts of load. There are currently in excess of 400 megawatts of generation being injected in that same system, and it's that order of magnitude problem. Load was small compared to the generation that we're trying to affect there that's causing some of the transmission constraints that we're trying to deal with.
Representative Lagunas.
Thank you. In your writings, you assume some growth rate, but I didn't see it in here, and maybe I was missing it, so I was just going to ask you what growth rate you were of electricity you were assuming by 2020.
The Midwest ISO, I'm sorry, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Madam. The Midwest ISO does not in its own right make energy growth forecasts. We instead use the forecasts represented to us by the utilities that are our customer members. I believe there's a member of the audience that could answer your question directly. Mr. Terry Grove is here from CapEx. To my recollection, the growth rate was on the order of 2.5%.
Representative Wiggins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if we were to have a more aggressive conservation of energy than we've had historically, then that growth rate would be different. And so it's very difficult for us to look at a one number and use that as something that is particularly reliable. Generally speaking, it's much more helpful if we have a range. And you can say, well, if growth was 1%, because we are going to be far more careful about the use of electricity, and we're going to get more bang for the buck out of our electricity, then we wouldn't be, the 25% would be a very different number than the 5,700 megawatts that you put down here. So as you all give us information in the future, it would be much more helpful to have a high and a low, and this is the range, because it's not very instructive to have just a single number anymore.
Yes, Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mueller, I'm looking at slide number 11. You have, and it looks like in slides 10, 11, and 12, you're looking at, well, up to 25% of wind energy can be accepted if these certain case scenarios happen. And I'm looking at slide 11, the last two statements there. It says from Minnesota to the rest of the MISO to access the markets, and especially your last statement there, other states must agree to build the transmission. Could you talk a little more about that? What other states have to do for us to reach the 25% level?
Sure.
Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The the issues around transmission have to do with the need to be able to balance the load and generation in real time, and also the need to not completely turn off the old-style steam plants in the region. So, for example, the ability to, on a fluctuating basis, move energy from Minnesota into Wisconsin, from Wisconsin into Illinois, from Minnesota into Iowa, from Iowa to Minnesota, those sorts of connections are vital to make that 116,000 megawatt kind of marketplace work that we're using to adjust so that the wind energy doesn't oversupply the system. So it's that ability to not oversupply and then, as wind tapers off, resupply the load is what we're using those connections for. On another slide, I suggested that we hadn't done the exact design of what that transmission is, and that would be our next step. Once there is a good understanding of what a portfolio standard is, it would be important for us to take the time to, in fact, design the system to accommodate that standard, along with a standard that is in Iowa. There's a standard in Wisconsin. There's a pending standard in Indiana as well, Michigan.
So, Representative Magnus?
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. When would you expect MISO to do that design, and how long do you think it would take to do it?
Mr. Muller.
Thank you, sir. We, in collaboration with our utilities, would expect that to take on the order of a year to make sure that we've got an effective and appropriate design that can be trusted.
Thanks.
And Mr. Muller, if I could follow that up briefly. Since we're talking about wind in Minnesota, what you're saying basically is that we don't have the capability of cutting back the other generation that serves Minnesota sufficiently to accommodate an increase in wind generation without going more broadly into the grid. Is that correct?
Yeah. Let me try to amplify the situation. If we had, for example, a very high wind day and all of the generation was on, and so much generation that we needed to take off some of the large steam plants like Sherco or Boswell or one of those, and then the next day the wind is not blowing as robustly, it takes about 48 hours to restart one of those plants. So a preferential way would be to bring those plants to something more like their minimum load, but keep them online so that they can react as the wind dissipates. So it's those connections between this region and other regions that allow us the flexibility to accommodate the fluctuations in that wind generation.
So, Mr. Muller, I guess what my question was, and thank you, that helps to clarify it, but are you saying then that we don't really have the capability to reduce the other generating facilities that are feeding Minnesota minimally enough to accommodate that kind of wind increase? And
there would be other sorts of investments and costs that would be incurred in order to accommodate that. It would probably, I'm making this part up, okay, because I haven't done a study, but it would likely include the addition of more combustion turbine kind of generation capacity, so that should those plants need to be backed down, there are other generators that start very quickly that can accommodate it. So it's more a matter of cost than it is whether or not it's technically feasible.
Thank you. I presume that other types of generation would include biomass.
A biomass kind of generation, with the exception of methane from landfills, a traditional biomass kind of generation is a steam-based generation, and it has lengthy startup sequences in the order of a day or two as well, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Muller,
How would a conservation goal of, let's say, 1% reduction in demand affect you test the recommendations that you're testifying about today? How would 1.5%, 2%, 10%?
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, sir. The study that this is talking about talks about how much of how much wind on a percentage of total load, regardless of whether that's a big number or a small number. The important thing to contemplate is, should a wind target be, for example, 5,700 megawatts, which is, you know, the one number that we happen to pick, that wind could be accommodated with more displacement of old generation, and then the number would be, say, 26% instead of 25 or 24% of the portfolio. So the point of this study was to talk about how to integrate large amounts of wind. It wasn't to talk about how much generation in aggregate would be needed based on those various growth rates. It is accurate that a lower growth rate will require less investment in traditional generation, traditional kinds of combustion, but you can separate that question from how much wind might be an appropriate wind target for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, a couple of questions. You made the comment about distributed generation fits into the infrastructure better. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think I understand what you're saying. You get a better distributed generation, but you also get better use of infrastructure that might not be used to its max capacity right now. Second thing you had talked about is implement something when as practical, not as soon as possible. That struck me as something that is wise. In the past year and a half, I think we've seen that maybe with the wind turbines being affected by some of the steel markets and concrete markets that probably were driven up by Hurricane Katrina and the Chinese demand, et cetera, but is that the kind of phenomenon you're also talking about, that planning for it helps keep the costs from artificially being driven up? And two questions there, and then I have another question after that.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative Westrum. The amount of value we can achieve by distributing generation is an important attribute that needs to be quantified so that we're careful to full utilize as much of the wires in the air as we can. It's important to note that the distribution systems particularly were not designed for energy to come out of them. They were only designed for energy to go into them. So there are technical things that have to happen at the substations to accommodate that bidirectional energy flow in a distribution system. It's standard kinds of work, but it's work that has to be done. It's not a slam dunk. So to the degree that we can effectively distribute generation, that's a useful thing. We have to think about that distribution in accordance with where the opportunity for the generation is, particularly as you look at wind. There are some sites that might have plenty of transmission infrastructure but no wind, and unfortunately we have places with plenty of wind and no transmission infrastructure. And so those are the kinds of things that that we want to be mindful about as we design this. And the second question that you asked, that is exactly the phenomenon that I'm cautioning against. A standard that says, you know, 20% wind in the U.S. by 2020 is very different than a 20% wind in Minnesota by 2020. If only Minnesota had that standard, then the demand for turbines and steel and generation machines wouldn't spike that price. But because those other things are going on around us, we have to be mindful about those realities as we integrate this sorts of technology.
Representative Westman.
Chair, I actually forgot about my next question, so when I think of it, I'll raise my arm again.
All right. Well, Representative Westman, there seems to be no further questions, and we're kind of on schedule here. Oh, Representative Beard has stepped in to give you a little thinking time. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I did have a couple things I wanted Mr. Mueller to expound on. And this may not be your area of expertise, but if you're with MISO, you've probably seen the operating parameters over the last several years since we've been putting wind on the grid. But has there ever been a day when there has been no power coming from any of the wind areas? Has it ever gotten that poor on a poor day?
Mr. Miller.
Zero is a pretty small number. I don't recall ever seeing a total of zero between the wind farms in Iowa and Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But my knowledge of that is once a month walk through the control room and look, sir. So I wouldn't call that a definitive answer.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Related to that then, my hunch is no, and I know that the technology has gotten a lot better over the last 20-some years. We've been pushing at this so that even on days when at the surface it seems like light and variable, I know at 200 or 300 feet there might be enough, and the blade technology is such it can actually generate power. But thinking about the distributed generation from another perspective, and that of is that of weather fronts moving across the larger area, it would seem that the way the fronts move, having a long string of wind generation, say from maybe the Black Hills all the way into western Minnesota, might make some sense if the transmission didn't get too expensive, where we continually have a push of wind power along those lines. Is that part of the distributed generation we want to be thinking of, or you just think about generation closer to load centers?
Mr. Miller.
Yeah, thank you, sir, Representative. That is precisely the kind of distributed thing that we're thinking about. I do have two data points that I think can be instructive. Mm-hmm. Last summer we had two very hot days in a row in late July and early August. On the first of those days, this region, this third of the Midwest ISO, had its maximum demand. Of the 800 megawatts of wind that are connected to this part of the system, we had a very low amount of wind output, 30-50 kind of megawatts. But the following day, which was the peak day for the Midwest ISO system, those same machines produced nearly 400 megawatts of wind. So that the ability to use that wind across this wide region also increases the value of wind in terms of the raw price for the commodity that happens as a result of injecting that wind.
To that, maybe wrap up for this moment on this line. I'm just, and you may not, you don't have to react to this, Mr. Mueller, but just as I've been around this the last, well, 20-some years, but most intimately the last 4 or 5 years, one thing that concerns me a great deal is the degree of parochialism that's come into this discussion. It's got to be Minnesota wind, or somehow it's not nearly as righteous or valuable in the whole scheme of things. And I think what I'm hearing here is that if we're going to do this right, we need other states. We need to be counting and cooperating with our friends in Iowa and South Dakota, North Dakota, and so on and so forth. So I just maybe just make that statement and leave that for our contemplation, because it appears that Mr. Westrom has remembered what it was he wanted to talk about.
So it seems, Representative Beard. Mr. Mueller, before we go to Representative Westrom, would you like to comment on that?
I do encourage the interaction with the neighboring states, particularly these states that have the opportunity to contribute to the solution for the nation. It would be unfortunate if we construct an infrastructure that didn't allow this region to contribute the good resource that it has to the national energy problem.
Thank you. Members, we have Representative Westrom and Representative Peterson, and then we are going to have to move on to keep with the agenda. So, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. Mr. Mueller, related to the transmission lines, and this is a statement and a question. Just what is your reaction? And maybe it's not even true, but I've heard from some different folks in western and southern Minnesota tell me that in recent months, in the last year, there's been a phenomenon that's been taking place where large companies come in and reserve large quantities of megawatts on transmission lines, some coming in from the Dakotas, but in effect it also locks out any future generators or seabed projects or other projects that might want to come online that are maybe 20 or 50 megawatts versus 100 or 1,000 or 5,000 megawatts. Has MISO experienced some of those applications coming in? Is what I'm hearing true? Is that a way to reserve the lines and kind of block out any future projects and you get first in line? Is that not been in your experience?
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, sir. It has unfortunately been our experience that when a given utility might have a request for proposals for, say, 800 or 1,000 megawatts of wind, we will find in our interconnection queue up to 5,000 megawatts of wind of bidders that are seeking to have a competitive advantage on other bidders by being in that queue first. Among the things that are problematic about the first-in, first-out nature of queuing is precisely that problem.
So, Mr. Chair, I know I realize your time issue. Just on that point, then, does that lapse after a period of time and the project doesn't go forward, or how long can they keep that application open without building, and what kind of money does it cost to put your application in the queue to lock up that many megawatts? Is it the same?
Mr. Mahler.
Thank you, sir. The fee to proceed from the into the feasibility study is $50,000 for all comers. So the study itself, it requires a $50,000 deposit. The study is then performed, and any leftover money is returned. There are several places along the way where there is additional money requested, and the requesting party can either quit or proceed. The entire regulatory process through from interconnection request to the final execution and construction is by design 600 days long.
Sir, I'll be real quick. So the 600 days is the longest they can keep that transmission line reserved for themselves. And does a 1,000 megawatts cost $50,000 plus or minus a little, similar to a 20-megawatt project, or do they pay so much more per megawatt once they get into the study?
Mr. Mahler.
Thank you, sir. The studies themselves vary in price. What we have done in Southwest Minnesota specifically in an attempt to mitigate that problem is we've taken all requests that happen at a similar point in time and combined all those requests in what we call a group study, so that the large request of 1,000 is grouped with three requests of 200, and they all participate together in that $50,000 study. So that's what we've attempted to do inside our FERC tariff rules to mitigate that problem.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on to,
point? No,
on to what Mr. Representative Beard said about the ownership or the development and how it does or does not occur, I'm wondering if Mr. Eliff could maybe comment on when does the Commerce Clause come into effect between, you know, if it's how much Minnesota wind, could we get in trouble if we make it exclusively Minnesota? And I've asked the Attorney General's office, I haven't found a case in another state that has a renewable energy standard that's been challenged. But I'm just wondering, you know, if there's legal advice on the Commerce Clause and interstate, production of wind. And if you don't have it now, you can do it some other time. But I'm reminding everybody that what you said about the day when it was hot and you were maxed out. I do recall a couple days later, Katie Couric was on the national news, and there was a story about the benefit of backup renewables and how that definitely kept everything in check those couple, 3 or 4 days when it was over 100 degrees. So, you know, when they say it's 105 and winds are out of the southwest from 17 to 24 miles an hour, that is a benefit.
Mr. Ilofsky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I haven't seen anything specifically on wind, but I'm aware of some cases out there that are analogous, okay? And obviously, that's the size, the difference between those two is very important, but I will begin to investigate that, sure.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you,
briefly.
Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. We have about 800 megawatts of wind now. What's the maximum amount of that 800 megawatts that our transmission capacity right now today can take on?
Thank you, sir. The 800 megawatts that I spoke of included two wind farms, one in Iowa and one in Minnesota. We've done some tricks to uprate the lines based on the wind speed. It requires additional construction to have any additional wind available. That construction is underway in southwest Minnesota, for example, and there are continuously pending cases that are attempting to increase the transmission capability to accommodate more wind. But at this point in time, any wind request would require additional transmission capacity in order to make it a secure resource, sir.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I live in that area in Buffalo Ridge, and I know all the turbines don't turn all the time. I don't care how fast it is, because we're not getting rid of the juice. So that was the basis of, and I wanted to know of the 800 megawatts, how many are, can we actually get out of there now? So, but
I'm not a good
answer. Mr. Mullen. Representative Welty, I'm going to vote the entire meeting to one testifier.
Thank you, Chairman Healthy. This is a quick question to follow up on Representative Magnus's question. I've heard it from constituents in my district when they're driving by Dodge Center. On a windy day, they see 70% of the turbines spinning and 30% of them are shut off. And there's always been speculation as to why those are shut off. And, of course, some people will say it's because of the base load and transmission. Is it determined by the generator, by like that single wind farm? Is it determined by the region? Is it determined by MISO? How many of those turbines spin at one time? Can you kind of give me an idea of how that is regulated and why on a windy day not all of the turbines are operating and what it's going to take to make sure that those wind turbines can operate?
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, sir. There are several elements in answer to your question. First of all, I would suggest that there may be mechanical problems with a small subset of those turbines, and they're merely forced out for electrical or mechanical reasons. The second thing that happens, to the degree those wind machines are being used in the Midwest ISO market, they have a category of status that we call price taker, which says they are always the machines that are dispatched first to their complete capability. So in the pecking order of economic dispatch, a wind machine always wins. And it's only not dispatched if there's physically not space in the transmission system to dispatch them. So they, in effect, have priority dispatch within the market. So to the degree there are machines that are available and are not running, they would be not running because of insufficient transmission capability. That insufficient capability could be because there are other transmission elements forced out. Okay? It's very common to have other elements of the transmission system unavailable, which also cause derates in the capacity. But wind is always first in and last off in the dispatching pecking order.
Thank you, members. We do have to move on. Thank you very much, Mr. Mueller. We may have occasion to ask you back. I hope we will be able to do that. Next on the agenda, we have Mike Michaud. Mr. Jewell, if you want to come up with them, that would be fine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westrom.
Just while they're coming to Representative Pearson's question on the Commerce Clause, perhaps we should ask the Attorney General's office to come and talk to us a little bit about that issue if they would be so inclined.
Representative Westrom, we have had a meeting with the Attorney General's office to raise that question, and as soon as we get a response, we'll ask him to come and share it with the rest of us.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Mr. Michaud, welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Michaud. I'm a consultant for the Community-Based Energy Development Group. And with me today is Dan Jewell, whom I'm sure all of you know. Mr. Jewell will make some introductory comments, and then I'll speak.
Mr. Jewell.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan Jewell. I'm from Woodstock, Minnesota. I help Representative Magnus's hometown. And I work down there developing small wind projects and helping communities, farmers, and small business get involved in wind energy as an economic development tool. And we're here today to talk about the transmission work that we've been working on as CBED. CBED is a nonprofit organization that's sole purpose in life is to find ways to help communities get involved in the production of energy for their own communities. And what Mike will be talking about is the underlying studies that are being done as part of the CapEx transmission study, which shows that there's a substantial amount of generation that can be injected into our system for a minimal amount of cost distributed throughout the whole state of Minnesota, which will allow us to step up and do the standards we're talking about doing in a very economic fashion, and at the same time create literally billions of dollars of economic activity and development in the state. And the things that we work on through CBED also in Representative Magnus' district last year, we were able to lure one of the manufacturers from India to bring a blade plant. They built a $15 million blade facility because of the work that CBED is doing in opening up this market and creating this development. And this transmission study literally lays the groundwork for us to really push that and make this something really meaningful. To us, this is much more than just an energy issue. This is a huge economic development opportunity for all of Minnesota that we can really leverage into something real and meaningful in the long term. So I think we'll start with Mike giving us an overview of the CBED transmission and what it is and where it's going.
Mr. Michaud.
Mr. Chair, CBED by its nature is likely to be dispersed smaller type generation projects, and that largely falls from the fact that the communities and individuals who might be building CBED projects are not always going to be able to get $200 million to build large scale projects or more. So, you know, it's by their nature, we could probably expect to see most of the CBED projects to be under 100 megawatts or so. And so when you start talking about where would you put these smaller projects, and you look at the grid, the way it has been developed over time, you begin to ask yourself about the existing infrastructure that's already in place, like the substations that have been installed over the years to serve load in all the cities, towns, et cetera, that are scattered around Minnesota. And, well, you heard from Mr. Mueller that the distribution side of things wasn't designed to have generators on them. Let me say that it can generally easily accommodate generators. The core guts of the distribution system, the poles, the wires, and the substation transformers don't care which way the power flows. The thing that we have to typically watch out for is the control systems and the protection systems that are built into the distribution systems. They simply did not anticipate that there could be two-way power flow, but the system is built for two-way power flow as it is for the most part. So one of the questions that we had in our minds was just how much of a short-term development advantage is there to using these existing substations sort of as on-ramps to the high-voltage power grid. We teamed up with the CapEx people and the Department of Commerce to do an investigation of a small section of the state of Minnesota, and we picked the west central part of the state. And I've given you a handout on page 2 of that handout. You can see a map of the focus of the study area. It's 17 counties, basically, between the Twin Cities suburbs and the Dakota border. And also on that map, you can see all the other different transmission zones that the state has been divided into for transmission planning purposes. And we took a look at trying to utilize all the injection points that there were in this study region, and we inventoried all the substations that are available there, and we came up with a total theoretical injection capability utilizing those substations to the max and considering how much load is already in the area of about 3,500 megawatts for just that west central zone in the state. Now, we don't want you to think that we can actually get there easily, but it's an interesting number for an upper theoretical limit. But I think the sheer magnitude of the number is important, and I'll speak more to that later. When we did the modeling in this study, we took a look at that breakpoint between distribution and transmission, which is roughly at the 100 kV level in the power system. And so we took and located all the different places in the west central zone where you could inject power at the 115 kV level up into the system. And there were approximately 57 injection points that were available in those counties. And so we modeled putting generators at each of those 57 injection points and up to the maximum theoretical limit that's possible. This was the first study of this type that I'm aware of, and the point I want to make about that is that transmission planners conventionally don't think of studying the system in these terms. You know, traditionally we've been looking at large-scale generation plants located remote from load, and if you keep in mind that the primary function of transmission is to interconnect generation and load, your assumptions about what kind of generators are going to exist in the future are crucial to the optimal transmission result that you get when you do the planning study. And I don't have to remind you that when we're talking about 2020, that's 15 years from now, roughly. And, you know, if you think back 15 years about what we thought the world was going to be like today, the world today is a lot different than it looked from the people 15 years ago. 15 years from now, there's going to be loads on the system that we can't even envision. There's going to be opportunities for hydrogen storage. Electric cars are going to get plugged in at night. The whole load growth forecast that we're making today are likely not correct because we can't see the future clairvoyantly. And so when what I'm getting back to is we took a look at trying to study this west central region under a specific set of generator assumptions, these 53 to 57 locations, and what could we get out of the area. Under our study assumptions, we took a look at how much it costs to add transmission every time you added more generation. And we took a look at the breakpoints where the cost started to go up a little bit. And we focused on studying 800 megawatts and 1,400 megawatts of injection levels in explicit detail. And what we came up with in that study and what we used was a 2009 model of the power grid, which is essentially the grid we have today, a little bit more load growth and a little more facilities. And we took a look at essentially utilizing the existing system to see what we could get out of the West Central region in terms of additional dispersed generation capability. And from our study, we delivered that generation to the gas peaking plants in Minnesota. As Mr. Moeller mentioned, you always have to balance the amount of generation and load in the model. So as we brought the wind up, we backed down the gas plants in Minnesota, the most expensive kind of generation. And what we came up with was that there were less than $100 million worth of transmission infrastructure enhancements required in order to make that 1,400 megawatts deliverable to those Minnesota gas plants. And I think that's a pretty significant number, because in the world of transmission infrastructure developments, you're used to hearing of numbers in billions of dollars in scale, and this we could accomplish this for less than $100 million. And just for you, put that $100 million in perspective, we did a calculation using Department of Commerce costs for gas plants and wind plants, and the energy savings that comes with displacing gas with that wind amounts to about $100 million a year if it all goes to displacing gas. Something else we got out of this study were some really wonderful maps. Page 3 of your handout has a map of the West Central Zone, and it probably looks like a little bunch of black dots and lines because the scale is so small. But we have these maps in PDF versions that you can zoom in on them. And what this is a map of the transmission system in the West Central Zone with each of the substations located geographically. And then overlaid on that is the magnitude of the wind resource and what the capacity factor of a wind turbine would be at the different locations in the West Central Zone. So this map allows a person to take a look at a given county, a given area in the county, and be able to tell if there's infrastructure available that you could use to connect projects to. And we're really grateful for the utilities' work in developing these maps, and they saw the value in them in the map as well, and we were able to produce these maps for the whole state now. The only one that isn't done is for the Twin Cities metro area, but we do have maps like this available online. And I've given you a footnote where that is there at the CapEx 2020 website. And the last handout, the last page of my handout is just a real close-up perspective of one part of this map, and it happens to be around the city of Morris, Minnesota. And you can, every little vertical line there is a substation, and every circle with a number in it is the theoretical maximum amount of megawatts that can be injected at those areas according to our methodology. And so you can see what a tool this is to potential developers, you know, to go and try to pick locations where you could possibly inject energy. Let me just quickly move on to the significance for the rest of the state. When we inventoried all the other regions of the state, we came up with the numbers I've listed in my handout for the amounts of theoretical injection capacity. Southeast Minnesota has about 4,000 megawatts. Southwest Minnesota, interestingly enough, has 1,100. Northwest Minnesota is 2,600, and Northeast Minnesota is about 2,380. But what this means is that there's over 10,000 megawatts of already built and existing on-ramps in the state in our windiest regions that have the inherent capability to be used to provide power in both directions. What we found in the West Central Zone, 1,400 megawatts out of 3,500 megawatts could be delivered for relatively low cost. That's almost 50% of that theoretical level. And our experience with Southwest Minnesota is that we were able to develop 425 megawatts worth of wind in that area without building significant infrastructure. We did build some 115 out there. And that, again, is about half of what's available in the 1,100 megawatts that's of substations that's installed in the Southwest. So if that kind of rule of thumb holds true throughout the state, you know, we might be looking at the possibility of getting 5,000 megawatts of this first generation into the grid based on the existing built-in on-ramp capacity. So we think that there's possibly a big potential here in analyzing and utilizing this existing infrastructure to develop new generation resources. And to the extent that we can continue the study work that we've just barely begun here, and I must emphasize just barely begun, and verify with computerized modeling and science about what is the infrastructure necessary to actually use this existing system better, we can better inform the policy debate about what backbone system enhancements are in the public interest. And realistically, the more efficiently we can utilize our sunk capital costs in the existing system, the better off we're going to be. Lastly, I'd like to say a little bit about MISO and versus the state on interconnection jurisdiction. MISO, as you heard from Mr. Moeller, essentially manages the high-voltage grid, 100 kV and above facilities. And as Mr. Moeller said, MISO is a creature of FERC. It only has authority where FERC has legal jurisdiction, and its authority is primarily over the wholesale power market. So the state has the jurisdiction over the distribution system and for retail energy transactions between the load-serving utilities and their customers. And I want to remind you that the seabed tariff that we passed into law a couple of years ago is a retail type of a tariff between the utility and its customers. So we think that the state has the opportunity to step in and manage the interconnection process, you know, to these distribution scale facilities that in a matter that will facilitate the development of this first generation. And to that extent, that we think the state can develop its own queue system for projects that are interconnected to the distribution system and have a speedy process that will get them studied and interconnected. And with that, I'll close and let Mr. Jewell close.
Mr. Jewell? The best thing we could do is entertain questions at this point because I'm sure there's a lot of different ones.
Yes. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either of you. I've looked at, on CapEx 2020, this study, and I'm just wondering, you know, before we go any further, is anybody going to come up later on and say you're wrong, that, you know, this is not true? Do you see what I'm after? Because, you know, I've heard different variations on how much transmission is needed and where it's needed and where it's not needed. And, you know, as we know, the capacity factor, like it or not, is better in the Dakotas. And in North Dakota, you know, 50, 51, 48, west of Milbank, you know, it's better. You know, this tops out at 40, 42 type of thinking. So is it just is it a culture type of method as to how this gets developed, or do people just think you guys are wrong in your numbers? Just wondering.
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we've uncovered in our study is a certain set of facts,
yeah,
about how this system works and what it costs under the assumptions of that study to get 1,400 megawatts delivered to gas peakers in 2009. I mean, those facts are indisputable. You will not hear them be disputed. You know, and it was a peak model of the system, and I emphasize that we've just begun the study work. We can easily ask questions about, what happens in the off-peak time. We really need more study on this. And as I said, this has only opened the door. The other point I want to make is that wind speed alone is not the only decisive factor about whether or not a project can be economically developed. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of financial structures, cash flow, pro formas, and turbine costs. If you happen to get some nice low-cost turbines, you're really good in lesser wind. But my point is that we are generally attracted to the higher wind speeds because they generally are easier to cash flow as project sites, But if you don't have transmission and you're waiting 7 years for the next piece of transmission to get built, how many projects can you get done in the next 7 years that are still economical and a little lesser wind?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I'd just like to add that we all know that the Dakotas is touted as the Saudi Arabia of wind energy, whatever. But we have to remember that there's a difference between cost, price, and value. And when we're talking about utilizing existing infrastructure without having to spend billions of dollars to get renewable energy into our system and to our loads, that's a huge value. And the other huge value is obviously if we can use this as an economic development tool and keep our energy dollars in our communities, that's huge. And so that's what we have to look at when we're examining this whole debate, is when if we want renewable energy and we have the ability to utilize the existing infrastructure with minimal cost to get the power into the system, we can use that as a leverage tool to create lots of economic development throughout all of Minnesota. That's the value.
Well, quickly, so would you say that there's a cultural tension between what version of economic development is best when it comes to utility and the regulated industry of utility markets and such? I mean, is there people who just don't think it's valuable what you are advocating for versus a different way to make power historically? You know, far away, lights seem to work, no problems, CO2, global warming, climate change, big deal, not true. You know, I mean, what type of, you know, I see the value in what you're saying, and just, you know, since FDR, it's been done a certain way, and I'm trying to understand if they're saying that these megawatts are available at a low cost, then why does some of the other side of the debate start out with, can't do it, it costs billions of dollars in transmission, therefore a renewable energy standard should not be adopted?
Mr. Jewell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, there is, to say there's a cultural difference, I don't know if that's the words that I would use. There obviously is a difference in where does the money go?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're talking about. And when we're talking about literally billions of dollars, I mean, 4,000 megawatts represents billions of dollars to us. $4 billion in the economic, that's just at $1,000 a kilowatt. But, you know, obviously, if the utilities themselves were stepping up and building some of this stuff internally, that would help us. That keeps our dollars in our state and in our communities. But the best thing we can do is, if we're going to do it, we should leverage it so the communities out there that use this energy make this energy and keep those dollars in our community. And then on the part that we can just leverage it by our existing infrastructure is just a plus. And as Claire Moeller testified earlier, a distributive model is much more beneficial to the system. I mean, if the wind is blowing up in northern Minnesota, it might not be blowing down in southeastern Minnesota, but it moves around. The high low pressure systems move through. We see it in our wind farms all the time. We can see the wind coming, and we can schedule things around it. We schedule maintenance around wind speeds. And so distributing the system out is better for the system. Distributing the system out allows us to inject the power into the system economically, and distributing the system out allows local ownership to manifest.
Thank you,
gentlemen. We do need to move along. Mr. Jewell, I just wanted to say, in regard to your comment about South Dakota being the Saudi Arabia of wind, we're going to try to keep Minnesota from being the Iraq of wind in this process.
I agree, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the agenda, we have Beth Soho. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty and members. My name is Beth Soholt, S-O-H-O-L-T, and I'm with Wind on the Wires. There's a handout coming around for members that I'll follow. And I'll check my watch here. I know you're on a tight time frame today.
I appreciate that.
First, I wanted to start with some of the conclusions of my presentation and then give you a little bit of background about how Wind on the Wires has been working on transmission for wind development over the last 6 years. I think there have been a lot of questions in both the Senate committee as well as over here about whether transmission can be built in a timely manner for a 25% by 2020 RES. What I want to tell you today is that utilities, as well as MISO, and both separately and together, have completed a number of studies that include significant amounts of wind. And to date, we have identified transmission for roughly 2,000 megawatts of wind development. If we're going to 5,700, we have a ways to go. But we've clearly identified and are moving on transmission for the RES, for a higher number of RES. And not only have utilities been diligently studying a higher number, but they've also anticipated this higher number. And so I think they've been doing a lot behind the scenes to plan transmission and to look at what we need to meet that higher renewables number. MISO, again, I think as Mr. Mueller indicated, has been really looking at what they need to do with the transmission system. If we had a national renewable portfolio standard, how that would impact their 15 state and province of Manitoba footprint, as well as what happens if we have some global climate change legislation that pushes renewable energy to the forefront. And my main message today that I'll start with now and conclude with again is there's a lot more work to be done in transmission studies, but it's very doable. The utilities are fully prepared. I believe, not coming from one, but we've been working with them for a number of years, and I think they're really prepared to do transmission to meet a higher renewable energy standard. So let me just back up and give you a little background on Wind on the Wires. We were really organized in 2001 to make progress on removing the barriers to bringing wind power to market. Those barriers come in a number of buckets. Our members do include a broad spectrum of folks, and our work is really in three areas. Primarily, our focus is on the technical and regulatory pieces of transmission. We've worked hand-in-hand with the utilities and MISO over the last 6 years to really do integrated, proactive, forward-looking transmission planning for primarily wind, but renewables, in all kinds of renewables. We have aggregated information from wind developers, from the interconnection queues, from different sources, really aggregated all that information and brought that information to the transmission planners who need to answer certain questions. They need to know how many megawatts will be developed in a certain location. They need to know the location where those new wind generators are going to go. And then they need to know where that energy is going to try to be delivered. So they need those three pieces of information. And we've been able to work with wind developers to aggregate that kind of information and bring that forward in the planning process so that the utility transmission planning engineers have really good information to work with as they plan the system. We've also been involved in the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission cases where transmission is moving forward. We've been we work in Wisconsin, and if you turn to page 2, the top slide really shows the Wind on the Wires footprint. We're in the upper Midwest in 7 states, and we cover approximately half of the MISO footprint, but really work extensively with the MISO transmission planners. I think as the committee will remember, I know we have many new members, but Wind on the Wires also testified in 2005 when major energy legislation went through. And I think Representative Gunther was somebody we worked closely with on that legislation, as well as a number of other folks here on the committee. We really were a partner in moving that legislation forward and coming to in agreement with a variety of folks, and so that's very helpful background to go into the 2007 session with. I think it's important for members to understand, as we contemplate transmission and a higher renewable energy standard, that transmission is very complex. I think as you just listened to the first couple of speakers, your head was probably swimming with details and acronyms and lots of questions, a lot more questions than there are probably answers for. But one thing we know is that we cannot achieve a higher renewable energy standard without additional infrastructure. And so the infrastructure that we're contemplating and that is underway by the utilities right now is going to facilitate all types of wind. I think if you look at the community energy projects that want to develop in an area where there's very small load, you realize that the energy, once we get above just serving the local load, whether it's 40 or 50 megawatts, but we're generating 800 megawatts on Buffalo Ridge right now, that's got to move somewhere, and that means we need additional infrastructure to get the wind from the windy locations to where it can be used in the major load centers. And so we're looking at a number of studies and a number of things underway. If you look on page 2 on the slide at the bottom of the page, I just want to talk a moment about what is going on in wind development and what is in the process right now. So I said there were a number of studies, and those studies then moved to certificate of need through the regulatory process. And let me just kind of outline the things that we have done in Minnesota for wind generation here in Minnesota. One of the first things that Wind Down the Wires was involved in 2001 was a case for 4 new transmission lines in southwest Minnesota. There was a major 345 and 92-mile major 345 kilovolt transmission line and 3 other lines, as well as a couple dozen other fixes that had to be done in conjunction with those 4 new transmission lines. We intervened in the case to make sure that if we did do those transmission lines, we could assure to the highest likelihood, and that's, I put those in quotes, to the highest likelihood because you can't, in essence, reserve transmission for any type of generation. But we intervened to make sure that there were conditions on the certificates of need, that if they were, if the utilities were saying they were needed for wind power, then wind power would actually get to use the capacity on those new transmission lines. And we were successful at getting a good order out of the commission for those 4 new transmission lines in March of 2003. And I'm happy to report that those lines are now under construction in the Buffalo Ridge area. And we will have those, according to the schedule I think Excel has laid out, mostly done by the end of this year with a piece being completed in 2008. Let me just tell you kind of the time frame, because a lot of people have asked, well, how quickly can these be done? The study for these, for what will essentially move us to the 825 megawatt level off of Buffalo Ridge, the study began in the fall of 1999. The study took, approximately a year and a half. The certificates of need were filed in 2001. We went through the regulatory proceeding and had an order from the commission in March of 2003. And they had to be sited. The lines had to be sited and routed, which took probably another year. And now we're in the construction phase. And so, even though it seems like it's kind of a long process, if we do this in the right way and we have groups that are comfortable with what the new transmission is for from day one, from the very beginning, they participate in the studies. Once we get to the regulatory process, we can support those transmission lines and the elements that the utilities are asking to be certified because we know what it's going to be used for and we're comfortable with that. So that's just one example, a very good example of what can happen going forward. More good news, Representative Magnus, is that we have 3 new 115s that are being in the regulatory process by Xcel Energy. Those 3 new lower voltage, we call 115 kV lower voltage, will enable the next probably 350 to 400 megawatts off the Buffalo Ridge. Now, there are all sorts of projects that need that transmission, all sorts of ownership types. There's a lot of community energy that is waiting to utilize those new 115s. And so that's the second major piece of transmission that we have moving. The third piece is a line that is in CapEx Group 1. I think you heard from CapEx a week ago or so about the Group 1 line. There are four new lines, or three I think they've come forward with to date. But one of those new lines is from southwest Minnesota into the Twin Cities area. And that arguably is going to facilitate another 1,000 megawatts from southwest Minnesota. So you can see we quickly add up to several thousand megawatts of transmission that we've done. But there is more work that is ongoing, and some of that is the community-based energy development work that was talked about. I think it's important to remember that that we have a lot of different stakeholders in this process, and at the end of the day, the utilities are the ones that are going to have to actually move forward with getting the transmission done. And so it's going to be important for the utilities to feel comfortable with the results of those studies and what they really mean. I think I or anyone else can sit here and tell you what I think they mean, but until the utilities are comfortable that it's actually going to result in a robust transmission system for Minnesota and the whole MISO footprint, we really don't have anything to go to the bank on. So it'll be important for everyone to be comfortable with what's moving forward. And finally, if you turn to page 3, I just wanted to talk about the evolution of MISO transmission expansion planning, and then I would be glad to take your questions. MISO has moved along in their understanding of what kinds of wind is going to be developed in the MISO footprint. And really, in 2003, they did their first large transmission expansion plan. And they looked at what would be needed to move 10,000 megawatts of wind in the MISO footprint. In 2005, they did a little further iteration on the studies. And in 2006, they actually studied 20% wind in Minnesota and 10% across the entire MISO footprint. So that's the type of very proactive planning they're doing to try to anticipate what kind of transmission needs renewable energy standards or goals across the MISO footprint, what kind of transmission will be needed to actually move those goals. And until we have the transmission, we're just not going to get to those megawatt numbers. So what I wanted to do, I think you've heard from utilities that they're nervous about being able to get enough transmission going to meet a higher renewable energy standard in a timely manner. But I really wanted to highlight the good work that they've been doing and the positive aspects of transmission that I think are doable. Yes, there's more work to be done, but these guys are in the business, the transmission planners are in the business of doing this day in and day out. And I'm confident that if the legislature sets a renewable energy standard, an aggressive one, that the utilities will ultimately be able to meet the requirements of the planning and doing transmission, getting it through the regulatory process and constructed in a timely manner so that we can meet an aggressive renewable energy standard. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Holt. Members, we do have one more testifier, and actually Mr. Grove also from CapEx 2020 had asked to make some remarks today. Mr. Grove, I think that what we're going to have to do is ask you to come back on Wednesday. We'll give you some time at the beginning of the meeting when we take up Representative Peterson's bill. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope I'll try to be brief. I cut my teeth on a power line issue in Chisago County, the Chisago project.
Sorry about that.
I think you can take one look at my teeth and determine what effect it had on me. But more importantly, on the community, I know that we were one of the first, if not the first, in FERC history to win one of these arguments, because we fought it on need. And NSP, now XL, is bringing the line that we ultimately said was the line that that was the best electrical solution. But the lack of conservation investment and sort of the lack of aggressive renewable sources and renewable strategy were two of the things that I think got us most up in arms, saying that, yes, not in our backyard, but also that the whole system is not a wise system for the 21st century. And I am really curious, Ms. Solholt, you characterized that citizen groups are much more amenable when they now, I think you were characterizing the 345 line, perhaps. But can you just clarify that is the experience on the ground, that some of these questions being answered by community groups makes the permitting process easier? Is that correct? So we can be more optimistic about timelines for getting transmission lines up and running?
Waiting for the chair to roll, but...
That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think there were important lessons learned in the Southwest Minnesota case, and one of those is that stakeholder groups need to be comfortable with what the utilities are coming forward with. And if they are, the process can move fairly smoothly, and I guess I'll qualify fairly by saying these are always going to be very controversial. There's a lot of moving pieces to these and a lot of things for the Public Utilities Commission to take into consideration as they rule on the certificates of need. And I can only speak from my perspective, but I think it is really important for folks to be in the study process from the beginning. That's why we've worked long and hard with utilities and MISO to really have an open planning process. But I think there is something to the fact, too, that folks are much more, seem to be, and we only have one case, but seem to be much more accepting of power lines in their backyard when they know there might be some benefits for them down the road, and the lines carry renewable energy. And so those two factors seem to be moving us in the right direction as far as accepting infrastructure.
I could, real quickly, Mr. Chair. My experience is that Xcel and other utilities have also gotten much better at working with the community, regardless of the source of energy. But I'm extremely optimistic about the transmission situation and getting it done. Thank you, Ms. Solholt.
Ms. Solholt, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Overland, we'll give you about 10 minutes. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're running short on time, but Ms. Solholt, my question relates to the fact that you acknowledge the seabed study, and yet when the data that you referred to doesn't really take into account what we just heard previous to you about the potential for up to 5,000 megawatts of energy without significant new transmission being needed. So I'm asking, do you have disagreement with the data we heard prior to you?
So,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I tried to get away, but I didn't. I think that the utilities and the seabed folks would agree that the study's not completed yet. I think what I heard them say was, we have a data point right now of a certain megawatt amount, but that's a theoretical amount. And so what we need to do is complete the study and have the utilities feel comfortable with what those study results mean. We can do a lot of interesting studies and have information come out of those studies, but until it actually results in helping move infrastructure forward, we don't have anything yet. And so I guess I would characterize the study as yet too early to tell exactly what the result is going to yield. And I guess Wind on the Wires really has prided itself on sticking to the facts. And until we have a thoroughly vetted study that is, concluded to the very end to know what we have from the study, we have a missing piece. And so I certainly believe that, we need to be working on things that are nearer term, as well as working on midterm and longer term things. And I think given the goals that the legislature is likely to set for renewable energy standard, we're going to have to look at all possibilities. But until we've completed the study totally, we don't really know what the number is. That's why I have not really endorsed anything yet.
Thank you. Ms. Oberlin.
Mr. Chair, could I reschedule also to Wednesday? Is that possible?
We can give you a brief amount of time on Wednesday, but there's no meeting scheduled right now, so if members are willing to stick around for a few minutes, I think we can give you as much time today as we would be able to on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carol Overland, and at this point I'm not representing anyone in any transmission case, although I probably will be representing CRVC on the Chisago line. It's starting up again right now. I've worked on the Arrowhead Project, Southeast Metro, the Southwest Minnesota, and there's another one, Chisago, and in many venues, Minnesota, Wisconsin, in the agencies, in the appellate court. What's important here is coming around. The two things that I'm handing out are one little brief resources about transmission. That's the one that's entitled It's All Connected. And also with that is a picture of the map showing the coal plants and the new transmission lines that will be coming through. And that will show you exactly how the CapEx 2020 lines facilitate coal, because that's what they do. And then the final page in that handout is a list of the MISO-Q. This is for the MISO-Q for the area that is covered by CapEx. We have 16,024 megawatts of coal in the MISO-Q right now in the CapEx 2020 area. So what is it that we're doing with all this CapEx transmission? We need to look at that. So essentially, CapEx 2020 does facilitate coal. And I want to be very clear that in my transmission experience, but I'm not an electrical engineer, I am an attorney, I would absolutely fundamentally agree with Mr. Michaud in that we can distribute this, not distributed generation in the statutory sense here in Minnesota, which is a teeny tiny little amount, but distributed generation by the gas plants so that we can utilize the reservations and the transmission infrastructure. We need to do that. I was here before you in 2005 testifying about that. Those of you who are here, you may remember. We can do that, and we can do it now. And it's very important that we do, because right now we can make a decision. We don't need electricity. You're hearing everywhere we need 6,300 megawatts, but we really need 8,000 to make that up, because there's line loss, blah, blah, blah. But what they don't tell you when they say that is to look at page 7 of the CapEx report, that says at that time there was 16,712 megawatts of generation, of all kinds of generation. Now we've got that much just of coal, and there's a lot more of a little bit of natural gas, but not as much, and a lot of wind. And when Representative Magnus asked this question about, well, what about other states? We need to look at that, because where is the market for this Saudi Arabia of wind that needs all this transmission? If you look at Illinois, right now there's 8,000 megawatts sitting in line. So these other states are doing their part. So what do we need this transmission for? You know, we need to look at the market. And again, that map at the very back, no, the second to the last page, I'll send each of you a color map, because it is beautiful in color. And it shows the links between the coal plants that are out there. These CapEx lines start at the coal fields and come roaring through Minnesota. The Big Stone plant that you will see, that connects in as well. Now they say, oh no, it's not. It's really going only to Granite Falls, but that's not correct. They can't connect that plant. They have to go into phase 6 studies, which are starting like right about now, and the studies will not be completed until after the decision is made. And what the Phase 6 studies are doing is they're reviewing what will happen when they connect it to CapEx, because they need that to get that power out. So it's all an illusion. One thing that Ms. Silverholt was talking about that was disturbing to me was about the 345 kV project in the Southwest. And what she didn't disclose was that her organization, Piazza-Gualtney, North American Water Office, and MCEA and ME3 did a deal. And that deal was codified into the 2005 legislation. And that's very important that you understand what their perspective is when they're talking about transmission, because these are special interests with an interest in certain results. And that the settlement agreement is available on the web if you look for it. But if anyone's interested, I can get that to you. You need to look at what are the interests that the parties are representing. And so in this case, when you have parties advocating for transmission, why are they doing that? Who will benefit? Because we can do it without any new transmission. We don't need it. And so we don't need to be buying into the belief that we need transmission when we don't. It's not necessary. Minnesota has a statutory preference for distributed generation, not quite of the type that Mr. Michaud talked about, but similar. We have that preference. We have a preference for renewable energy. And so we need to pay attention to that and cite our generation in ways that fit with the statutes. This is crucial. We are at this point now with coal plants. We have Mesaba that I'm working on. We have Big Stone being permitted right now. That's 1,200 megawatts right there. Is this the kind of choice that we want to be making? And looking at CO2, do we want to be generating 5.4 or 6 million tons annually per plant? Is that what we want to do? This is the time to make that decision. We need to do that now. In the handout, I do have some examples of the lines, but I will send it to you because the color maps look a lot better than they do here, so we won't have to go through that. But it is important to look at the number one priority of Minnesota, statutorily, is conservation. And we can make that our priority, and we can avoid then building a lot of plants. We can increase easily, put solar on a number of roofs, cut the peak off. We can do our distributed generation. We do not need to build billions of dollars of transmission. And there's no need to build transmission to facilitate coal. The easiest way to do that would be to limit any transmission to 115 or lower. And we don't need to build 345 lines. And I'll leave it at that for now. Open to questions. Thank you.
Questions from members? Ms. Overland, we will try to, I'm sorry that we ran out of time today. We will try to accommodate further testimony from you in the future.
I would appreciate that. And I will send out the color maps because they look a lot better, and you can get a better feel for a real situation.
Thank you. Members, I would remind you that tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in the House Chambers in the Capitol, we are having a presentation on global warming featuring Will Steger, Dr. Tillman from the University of Minnesota, and others. I would encourage members to attend that presentation if at all possible. If there is no further business to come before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.